to Dive, Season 3, Episode 1. We're back in the studio. I'm back from England. And I've got my good friend, producer Jorge, running over here after he pushes the record button. I mean, it's Season 3, and we still haven't hired someone that could push the record button for you.
Yeah, we're still on that $50 budget.
Yeah, but we're killing it. We're really stretching that budget. PJ didn't make it over to England with us. He was making sure that NBC didn't light on fire here while we were gone, keeping everything in order. I still can't, and I don't really understand how we put that whole thing together. There's a lot that has to happen for us to have a pitch side gantry studio that all gets wired and mapped and pushed back here to an enormous group that are making it happen here.
Yeah, I still, to be honest, I've done it the last three, four
years. And you still don't know.
And I'm still confused by it all.
Oh, what a good start, though. What an amazing start. I love that we're doing this, that we're starting the season over there. It's just a really good way to kick things off. It was a bit unique this time, too, because we did a Transfer Deadline Day show. So for those that know, for those that don't, a new thing this year in the Premier League clubs voted, didn't all vote for this, but enough voted to close the transfer deadline window in England before everyone else, before the season starts. The theory being that it's a distraction. You start the season, you still have to deal with transfers. There are players that hold out. You know, you've got some players that join, some players that leave. It's just, it's a real disruption to the beginning of the Premier League season. So they closed it. I think it's a great idea for myriad reasons. I think it puts them in a really strong negotiating position. I mean, the hardest thing to do in a deal is walk away, and the transfer deadline for England happening before their season and everyone else continuing to go on in Europe forces them to walk away from deals. Yeah. And I think ultimately every other club, Europe, is going to catch up and go that way. Now, leagues start on different weekends, so it's never going to be perfect, but I just think it works. And we got to finally do a transfer deadline day show before the season starts, which is cool.
Which is good too. The only issue obviously is there are clubs that can still, other European clubs can still buy
players from England,
Premier League players,
but you can't replace them. So I mean, you know, clubs tend to do this. This happens when the window goes all the way to the end, a month into the season anyway. Mm-hmm. But at least now, when you say we can't replace you, you really can't replace them.
Yeah.
I mean, if Pogba or, you know, well,
that's a scary
one
thing.
Of these big things
or
that
Hazard end up leaving or something.
There's no,
like that.
I mean, there's just no way
they wouldn't
way.
Do it at this point because they know that, like you said, they can't be replaced.
Yeah,
unless it's just completely untenable situation or something like that.
Yeah, I just don't see that happening. I think it's a great thing, and you know, we'll see if other leagues catch up with that. But it was just cool. It was cool to start the season that way. We're at Old Trafford for that. We taped the Transfer Deadline Day show. We did a fun thing on that, and we typically do this to start the season, our predictions. And so we did our top four that day. If you missed it, that's good, because then there will be no spoiler alert here. I'm going to do not only my top four prediction for our Tad Pod to start off season three, I'm going to do top six in order of how I think they're going to finish. Now, I'm going to stick with what I thought before the weekend. That's changed maybe slightly, but I'm sticking to it because you can't just go off of one weekend.
That's fair.
You know, you can't be knee jerky like we always are. So I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to trust my intuition, which is always wrong, but I'm still going to go with it. But before we get into the pod, we're going to do that. We're going to do top six in order of how I think they're going to finish. Talk about what I think of them. Talk about how we thought the opening weekend went. But before we do that, we love to do our reviews. So keep them coming, guys. I mean, the only reason we're on season three is because you keep reviewing the show.
Yeah, we still don't understand how it works.
We don't. But like we don't know how we cover the show and pipe it back.
Positive
to the
or negative reviews, they somehow help.
Just review.
Just give us traffic.
Yeah. And Mom, you can't do more than one review, right? So last year we did a fun thing, the favorite player you'd like to play with. And so we're going to shut that down with Colorado Wolf. He had a great answer to this in that he mentioned a player for the first time in all of the reviews that we'd never heard of, that we actually had to look up. And the player that Colorado Wolf wanted to play with, Steve Bull. He said, if I could play with any player, it would have to be Steve Bull. He's one of the best English players to never play in the Premier League. He made 474 appearances for Wolves and scored 250 goals. I mean, sounds like a baller. I love listening to the pod. Really appreciate Kyle's take on the Premier League and the state of soccer in America. So thanks, Colorado Wolf, for that. Steve Bull, quite a player.
Yeah.
Really, really good goal scorer.
Played, I just looked it up, played from 1986 to 1999 for Wolves. And he actually played for the England national team for 13 caps.
I missed the bull.
1989 to 90s, but I don't think he played any, I'll double check, no major international tournaments or anything like that.
Amazing. Well, so that's the perfect one, an abstract answer to that, to close down that. For the reviews this year, we're going to do, put your review in and give us, I guess, stadium that you've never been to that you want to go to. Let's do that one. So any stadium in the world that you want to watch a football match, any stadium in the world that you haven't been to, where would you go? And forget Allegiance, right? Let's forget Club Alliance. I mean, it, you know, if you're an Everton supporter and you've always wanted to go to Anfield, you know, just let's be, that's probably not going to happen, but just go with anything. Stadium, atmosphere, iconic, and I'll throw one out that I haven't been to, the Maracanã. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really iconic.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's a stadium that, I mean, more in the international stage, I mean, you just see how special it's been to arguably some of the best teams we've ever seen play for Brazil. But, I mean, that stadium's insane.
I would say I've been lucky enough I did get to go to a game in 2014, Russia-Belgium. It was great. Yeah, it was great. It would have been great to see a Brazil game, I think, there. But it was still pretty cool to be in there and just think of all the, you know, all the historical moments that have happened there, going all the way back to, if you think, like the 1950 World Cup, which is what it's become most famous for. But
what about you?
Cool. For somewhere I haven't been.
You've been to a lot of stadiums.
I've been lucky. I've been to a lot. I actually would love to go to a Seattle for a Sounders game. I've never been there. There's a bunch of MLS stadiums like that. Portland, too. Kansas City, I've heard, it's really nice there, too. So there's a bunch of places like that. I think Seattle is the top one, though, based on everything I've seen on TV and what people have told me.
It's an incredible atmosphere. Yeah. I mean, to see an entire crowd that size standing the whole game is pretty is pretty special. So drop those in, you guys, and we'll read our favorite every week. So let's get into it. We're going to try to stick to 10 minutes per team. We know how difficult that is for me, but that's why PJ's here. So, number one, who I think will win the title this year, and I was the only one of our NBC crew to predict this. Which
a little surprising.
Yeah, I mean, I thought I'd get a few more takers. I will say Rebecca Lowe, behind the scenes, she's with me on this one.
Okay.
So, Rebecca and I will stand together throughout the season on this. Liverpool. Number one, Liverpool. So, I had Liverpool. Remember, we did our Tad Pod to begin last season. Mm-hmm. I put them in the top four, and I was the only one that had them in the top four last year. I just think with Jurgen Klopp, it's if you look at deconstruct what worked at Borussia Dortmund, no one thought he was going to be able to beat Bayern Munich to a title, let alone twice. I mean, no one expected them Champions League finals. No one really predicted that with that Borussia Dortmund team. Now, I think the ground to make up in terms of the Liverpool project might not be as big as it was with Borussia Dortmund when he took it over, but it was a slow burn. You know, each season a bit better. Each season promote a youngster. You know, Trent Alexander-Arnold is a good example of someone coming along who played so well and was trusted by Jurgen Klopp. He earned his way onto the plane to Russia with England and had a great World Cup. I mean, not a great World Cup. He did.
He was on the team.
Yeah, he was there. I mean, Trippier had a better World Cup. Yeah. I'm already confirmation biased. You know, gaslighting my listeners and making them think, did Trent Alexander-Arnold play really well in the World Cup? But yeah, it was great that he was at the World Cup, is what I meant to say. So, and then it's great identification of players that will fit into a system, and I think, if you look at, I mean, Salah's an easy answer there. But Firmino, Naby Keita recently, it's just really good buys that other clubs could have gone for these players. And he's constructed a team around either guys like James Milner that others weren't really interested in, or the Wijnaldums who, you know, getting relegated with clubs he identifies. I mean, just really good recruitment. And he has built a team that is irresistible and just really, they've really bought into what he's doing. I mean, from top to bottom, you can see everyone in the group understands the role. They I think are chaotic in a way that it's one of the only teams that really frustrates Manchester City and can get them off of their game. I don't think anyone else can do that to them. I think that, you know, things like Sturridge being maybe a new, you know, sort of that cliche of a new signing. I mean, already got a goal in the Premier League, was great in preseason. Yeah. He actually did play in preseason as opposed to Trent Alexander-Arnold in the World Cup. But, you know, I just they are a lot better than they were last year without having to do a ton to the squad.
Well, I was going to say, you just mentioned people buying into Klopp and the system and everything. And Sturridge looks like a completely it's early, but, you know, he looked legitimately happy coming off the bench. He got a goal, obviously, that helps. But it seems like that's a role he can embrace. And we'll see if someone like Shaqiri can do that too, another big signing. I think that's going to be the key because we saw, you know, when Salah was injured in the Champions League final, the depth in the attack was a problem.
Yeah.
Someone like Lallana, too, he's almost been forgotten. Mm-hmm. Can these guys all embrace coming off the bench and taking those secondary roles? You know, sort of similar to what Man City did last year where you saw a lot of these guys playing in cup competitions, which, you know, you say, oh, the League Cup or whatever, it doesn't matter. But Bernardo Silva, that's where he's getting his run, and then it gets him in form later in the season where they really need him. And I wonder if they can do that.
And here's what undercuts their, I mean, recently, and this goes back to Brendan Rodgers, defensive issues, right? So, I mean, yeah, the Steven Gerrard slip, and you know, there's some dramatic headlines for that season and things that they can point to, but it was defensive issues.
Yep.
And Alisson, I mean, this is finally a goalkeeper worthy of a title-winning team. I mean, they don't have to make any excuses for this guy. I mean, I've seen enough of the body of work that good off the line, good with his feet, great decision-making, strong shot stopper, but also I think is going to have a better back line in front of him than the goalkeepers before to kind of protect Karius and Mignolet a little bit because, you know, at times they were exposed unfairly where a lot of goalkeepers would have struggled. But Van Dijk, people forget, as good as he was last year, didn't have a preseason, but didn't have a like first third of the season.
Yeah.
I mean, he was out of it. So when he finally got his move to Liverpool, he was not game ready, especially for the intensity that Liverpool loved to play with. So if you're going to judge it off of opening weekend, they look the most dominant. Now, West Ham have their issues, but again, you know, that's an improved West Ham team. They spent a ton of money. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think only three clubs spent more net than West Ham did in the transfer window. So, you know, Liverpool, for me, I just think that each season under Jurgen Klopp, you get a little bit better. I think that top three is as irresistible as it gets. I mean, the Mane, who's back to his best, and that's taken some time after an injury. Firmino, who is one of the most selfless strikers, I think, in the entire Premier League. And Mo Salah, who's starting where he left off, shoulder not being a problem at all.
Yeah.
When you look behind that group, they've improved. And so, like you said, Shaqiri giving them depth if his mind's right, if his attitude's right. Sturridge, if he can stay fit or just understand that you have to play hurt.
Yeah.
And those guys buying into those roles, I think really what gets them there, and it's going to be a reach, right? What gets them there is the psychology of repeating. Only two clubs have ever done it. The last was Sir Alex Ferguson's Manchester United, right? So it's almost been a decade. Repeating's hard. There's always a bit of a dip. But also, I feel like for Manchester City, Pep Guardiola was brought in to win the Champions League. Mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately, no one will say that. That won't be on paper. But, you know, Pellegrini and, I mean, titles were happening before
Mancini won one.
Yeah, so before Pep got there, they had hit that mark. Mm-hmm. Now, he was expected to get back there for sure. But really, the two things I think that they said to him, Cheeky Begiristein, who we met briefly when we went over to watch Manchester City train. We also got a chance to sit down with Pep Guardiola, which I need an hour alone for that discussion. Maybe we'll just do like a special pod on my love affair with Pep Guardiola, because we sat there. It was incredible, the depth of his mind and how he thinks about the game. But the conversation would have been, leave a legacy. Mm-hmm. So help us build something that we can recreate all the way down through. We met with Brian Marwood and the academy directors. I mean, they want a blueprint a la La Masia and Barcelona. They want Pep to leave something behind that people can try and recreate a culture, an identity. So that's one thing, and that's a lot of ambition. I mean, that's a big challenge. Yeah. The next is Champions League. I mean, that's I think concentrating slightly on that is what Liverpool have to hope for. Liverpool have to hope for maybe an early-ish exit where, you know, they perform well, but now they can really just focus on the Premier League.
Yeah.
And I think they can do it.
Okay.
I do. So does Bex. So we're together on this one. Bex, sorry to throw you on the bus.
The one,
but you're with me.
The one he didn't play this weekend, I think because he's still coming back from the World Cup, is Dejan Lovren.
Mm.
He's going to be the one, depending on how he does,
sure.
I think it's going to be talked about. been, you can, this might be part of your answer to it, is the guy that filled in for him actually looked pretty good.
Gomez.
Yeah. Yeah. He could be another guy that, not a new signing, but almost feel like a new signing if he starts at center back regularly for them.
He's excellent. Yeah. He is.
Still and, only 21 years old,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, and that's his role. So he's been used as fullback. He's been used in other positions. That's the role he's the best at. That's where he's the strongest. You just, kind of like Trent Alexander-Arnold, there's going to be mistakes. There's going to be issues. It's going to need time. And you got to play him through that, I think. And listen, they have depth in that role, but they're hoping that partnership becomes good. One little fun thing I was thinking was Manchester United, and we'll get into them later, get into them a lot later, but we'll get into them later. They were in for Boateng, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was this transfer deadline day, big issue between Mourinho and Ed Woodward. Mourinho wasn't getting his guys. Woodward said, we're not going to back you for older players. It would have been amazing. I mean, maybe I'm just, like, thinking too much, like, WWE drama here. Yeah. But wouldn't it have been amazing if Liverpool went in and grabbed Boateng, right? I mean, just said you know, miss there. Manchester United missed on him, and then they signed Boateng. I mean, Boateng, obviously, he and Jurgen Klopp will know very well about one another in those battles in Bundesliga. But I just thought that would have been fun. But, yeah, Liverpool. I'm going big on Liverpool. They're going to win the title this year.
Okay.
So that means there's only one number two,
yeah,
and that's Manchester City. So, listen, all the other guys had Manchester City winning. Here's the thing. They won so dominantly that they don't have to be any better, really, to win the title this year. I mean, that's how far and away they were and how tiny everyone was in their rearview mirror. They were exceptional. And I said it on the podcast. Everyone got really upset about it. The best Premier League team we've ever seen. And I still think that. Now, you have to qualify that. I just think no one, and they ended up breaking all the records.
I would say the numbers back you up on it.
Yeah, I mean, no one has won the Premier League in a more dominant, aesthetically pleasing fashion than Manchester City did. It was incredible how they dismantled nearly every single team in the Premier League. And the season before, everyone said, there's no way they can do it. You can't win this way. And then Pep eventually won that way. Mm-hmm. So I look at them this season and I think we're going to see it evolve slightly. Pep is going to try to find new and interesting ways to beat clubs. Yeah. We sat down with him for about 15, 20 minutes. And I asked him, you know, in the first 10 minutes of a game, it seems that when we're in the studio, I look up on the tactical camera. You're working things out. You're observing, and then you're communicating, and then you're pointing, and you're what are you doing? And he said, well, I'm in the first 10 minutes of a game, I'm watching mostly the opposition, and I want to see how they're setting up. And I've got and he went through all of the kind of like a programmer does coding. He went through all of the answers. If you know, if X, then Y. Just went through the whole thing, and essentially he's just saying, did I watch the tape and do the research and work with my analysts and predict how they were going to set up. Uh-huh. If I did, great, we're set up, we're going to be good. If not, he'll make some minor tweaks. One minor tweak he made in the Arsenal game, last game of our trip, was Mendy played as that sort of inverted fullback, something he made famous at Bayern Munich with Alaba and Philipp Lahm. But we haven't seen him do that with Mendy. I mean, Mendy was hurt a lot of last year, but Mendy is a get chalk on your shoes, up and down on a track, you know, wide fullback. Typically, he'll invert a winger to let him play that way. So I thought it was really interesting that he and Raheem Sterling played on the same side. Mm-hmm. And Sterling came to our set afterwards and said, the only instruction he has from Pep Guardiola is they can't be on the same line. So if Mendy's wide, Sterling has to be inside. If it's Sterling's wide, Mendy needs to be inside. Yeah. So I just thought that was a little fascinating nuance, and we're going to watch Manchester City this year and figure out how are they going to be the same, but what's the minor tweak. And you know, one tough bit of news for Manchester City fans, the minor tweak may be how do they replace Kevin De Bruyne. And we don't know yet, but we just saw reports that he had suffered a knee injury in training.
I think the latest thing I saw is he might be headed to Barcelona
where he went last time he hurt his knee. So, listen, they've dealt with Kevin De Bruyne out for a little bit before. David Silva didn't even play in the opener. I mean, Mahrez and the extra role Bernardo's going to play this year. Yep. They have that covered, even if he's out for, 4 months, which we're all hoping he's not, because I know Manchester United fans, there's competition and you know, red blue, but you don't want to see any player that talented hurt. It's just a joy to watch him play, even if you hate him and even if you want Manchester City to lose. Yeah. So hopefully for Manchester City and for the neutrals, he's going to be okay, but that's a big loss, right?
Well, one thing I was going to ask you is, you know, we've a lot of other clubs have gotten criticized that we're going to talk about a little bit about not making enough summer signings. And Manchester City only made one signing, really, one big signing in Mahrez. But nobody seems concerned because of the depth that they had last year, and all these players are relatively young. So I think it just shows that even, like you just said, if De Bruyne goes down, they have all these options that can step in right away. I think the one position they probably are weak is Fernandinho. There's really no direct replacement for him. You could say Gundogan could drop in there, or De Bruyne technically could have, but...
Well, they wanted Jorginho, right? I mean, they were going for him.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But well, the other guy I was curious too is, did Pep, when you all met with him, did he bring up Phil Foden at all? Because that's another player that they said that a lot of people have been saying might actually start playing a big role this season.
Yeah, he didn't speak of him, but he spoke about competition, and he said, "Listen, one of the things about repeating and." Not only did he repeat twice, once at Barcelona and once at Bayern Munich, but it was a three-peat. I mean, he won three titles in a row, both of those places. Yep. It's about mentality, and if a player thinks, you know, I'm big time, I won, he said, you're going to sit right next to me, and he slapped the couch next to him, and Musto laughed. And then Musto asked when they're going to be playing golf, which I loved. I mean, that's another player that pushes, right? Yeah. Mahrez, it's tough for Foden when Mahrez has been brought in. Mm-hmm. Now, the two of them can play several roles, but I mean that's the answer. And how Manchester City repeat is that they basically have two first teams. Mm-hmm. I mean it's kind of embarrassing the depth that they have. It's really really remarkable. Yeah. And listen, that's a challenge in how you keep everyone happy, because every player in the 18 you could argue starts for any other Premier League side. Mm-hmm. I mean you can really plug most of these players in. The only ones you couldn't. That's where you really notice Pep Guardiola's strength, like the Otamendis. And even when he first got there, the Kyle Walkers, who many thought, like, I mean, really? Was he that great at Spurs that he deserves this huge salary? I mean, are Spurs going to miss him all that much? And I mean, he's been one of the most noticeable improvements in an individual under Pep Guardiola. I'd say Raheem Sterling, another one. Even Gundogan, who most people would lionize and say what a terrific player, and we noticed how important he was to Borussia Dortmund, but a series of very, very serious injuries, right? I mean, a lot of people will kind of balk at a player like that in a transfer window, and not only has he been great, but he's also their replacement in that deep role if they need one. Yeah. So, I mean, listen, it's going to be so hard to beat Manchester City this year, I think Liverpool are going to have to be close to perfect in order to do it. I just think that this Manchester City side, I say that they don't have to be better to win the title this year. I mean, they're going to be. Mm-hmm. I think John Stones is going to feature a bit more. That's an ongoing project that, you know, Pep loves but isn't just ready yet. He did have a good World Cup. Mm-hmm. The defensive issues that he has to figure out, I think – we saw in glimpses in the Arsenal game, he is improving in his positioning, his decision making, but there isn't a better center back, honestly, in the world bringing the ball out of the back. Yeah. I really think it's as good as it gets, and you know, beating Manchester City. If someone says, "How do you beat Manchester City? Who's going to beat Manchester City to the title?" It's like asking who's your favorite Robbie. You know, it's just you don't want to answer it. It's just a hard question to answer. But I think Liverpool are going to beat them. So I've got Manchester City at number two. All right, so number three. Another one that a lot of people didn't have in the top four last year that I put in that I've got in the top four this year, Spurs. You know, comical transfer window. I mean, absolutely comical. Not since Arsenal failed to buy an outfield player that year they bought Petr Cech. Spurs, the first time since the transfer window was founded, since this started
2003.
In 2003, nothing. Mm-hmm. Donut. I mean, that's incredible. Now, they're going to cry, you know, stadium, don't have the money, can't do it. Kind of like what we saw when Arsenal moved from Highbury to the Emirates. You know what I just don't understand about that is, like, it's not like they're paying for this out of their pocket. I mean, no one went to their mattress and got, you know, 800 million pounds out or took it out of the account. You're going to, just like when someone takes over a team, which also ends up being the salacious thing, like Stan Kroenke, who bought out Usmanov and now it owns Arsenal outright. Now, there's different arguments there because supporters trust and all that, and I totally get that. The modernization of the game, you know, losing the romanticism and the fan ownership, I get that. But the fact that he's using debt, that it's leveraged buyout, I mean, that's how everything is done these days. I mean, everything is financed, even player transfers. I mean, no one went and grabbed 222 million euros out of a bank account to buy, you know, Neymar when he went to PSG. Everything is financed. So what I just don't understand is Daniel Levy has one of the great accomplishments is he's kept the wage bill pretty low. So they still are overachieving in terms of what their operating cost is on wages. Mm-hmm. You know, his salary's pretty big, by the way. I mean, there's no other person in his position making more money than his £6 million, which doesn't look good right now when he's crying that we're broke.
Yeah.
But they can still spend in a transfer window when they're moving into a new stadium. I mean, of course they've taken on debt. Now they, you know, the when you look at the spreadsheet, the operating cost is going to be up, and they want to wait for season tickets and, you know, the suites and the sponsorship and everything to make the bottom line look better so they can start to spend again. But just like you're going to take debt out to build the stadium, take debt out to buy players. Mm-hmm. They didn't need to spend big.
Yeah.
They didn't need to buy a ton of players, but they needed two or three players to really ensure that not only they finish top four, but they have a chance to keep up with the front pack.
What areas do you think they should have been, strengthened in that they didn't?
A defensive midfield playmaker. I mean, I think Dyer has early promise has kind of faded a bit. I think he's not really, and listen, he hasn't had a ton of reps in that role, but he, Wanyama being hurt, Dembele being past his expiration date, as good as he is and as much as I love him, the word is, you know, his body's kind of not keeping up with the grind of the Premier League. It's funny, I said this to Graham Lasso. You know, they should have gone in big, made a huge statement for Luka Modric, but his buyout clause is basically what their stadium cost.
Well, and could you imagine if Real Madrid lost Cristiano Ronaldo and Luka Modric in the same summer, especially after Modric, you know, was the one of the key players in Croatia?
But he's being linked with Inter, he's being linked with clubs. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. They need Harry Winks is a player that
he might be
is
big
for the future, and you know he can definitely fill in the center of the park. You know, just a winger. You know, I know they don't typically play with wingers. Mm-hmm. They usually get a lot of their width out of fullbacks or wingbacks. And you know, the way they played this weekend against Newcastle was basically a 4-4-2 diamond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to see the ambition of, listen, keeping a lot of these guys is ambition. I mean, that will go unnoticed, right? People won't recognize new contracts and extensions and players like Kane and Dele Alli and Eriksen. There's a lot of interest in those guys. So keeping them while they're moving into a new stadium is a big thing. I have them in the top three because I think the continuity helps them. I think trust in this group, rather than there being complacency and thinking, you know what, I'm safe, my position's okay. I think Pochettino does a good job of making sure no one feels safe, but everyone feels supported. You know what I mean? That's kind of the Pochettino thing. Moving into the new stadium will help. Now, there is a delay on that, which they just recently announced, where they're going to have to play in Wembley and won't go into the stadium as quick as they thought, which hurts them for a few games. But Wembley didn't have the negative effect that everyone expected it to, right? But I do expect the new White Hart Lane to have a galvanizing positive effect for sure. And the calculus on how many points that gets them, I'm not sure. I just still look at them and think this is a really solid side. That, you know, have World Cup winners coming back, have young players that perform well in the World Cup. This is still a really, really good side.
Well, you know, you talk about wingers. There are a couple players, actually, that didn't play a ton last season, whether it was injury or they came in late. I'm thinking of Lucas Moura, who actually started this last game, and Eric Lamella, who's constantly seems to have injury problems. But maybe those are two players that he can almost look at. And I guess Lucas Moura is technically a new signing if you go back to the January window. So maybe he's thinking these guys, look, we haven't even gotten a good look at these two. Maybe they could work. You mentioned Harry Winks, which, by the way, I don't know what you think, what you make of when players get new numbers when the new season starts. Harry Winks is now number 8, which I forget what he was before, 29 or something
That's a big number.
It makes you, I read somewhere that that's because he's going to be, Pochettino is going to be relying on him a lot more this season, so he's giving him a more prominent, you know, midfield type of number. But
yeah,
so I don't know if he's just looking at, maybe he sees these, you know, these guys are my new signings. They didn't play much last year, and maybe they can come in and do the job.
Well, and here's the thing, too, is, and we'll get on to them, but with Manchester United, the lack of spending, even though only one club has spent more since Jose's been there. Now, this window feels a bit worse than I think if you put it in the context of the money he's been given and how much he's been supported since he's been there. You know, Pochettino's got to be mad, but how he's handled it is great, right? He hasn't made a big deal of it. He didn't draw this line in the sand in a divisive way of separating himself and Levy and putting all this pressure on, you know, on the executive. So, I just think a bad transfer window that will be forgotten with a good start to the season. I don't think there's any fear of losing any of their players before the international window's closed. I really don't see any business done in the winter. But listen, if they finish top four and are in a new stadium next summer, I just think they can have a lot of power in the transfer window. But it's also going to be that much harder to keep some of their players. I mean, they're really butting up against this wage structure that they have about making sure no one earns these, you know, these big 200,000-300,000 pound a week salaries. I mean, it's just at some day they're going to have to, if they want to win titles, keep up with the other clubs that are spending like that. But I don't know. I just feel good about Spurs. I know it's an underwhelming transfer window. It's just, if you go back the last three seasons, they're the most consistent team in the Premier League.
That's true. They finished, third, second, and third the last 3 years. So, real quick, do you think they need to – Danny Rose or Toby Alderweireld, those two players that were kind of
creating issues.
On the naughty list, I guess you want to say, for Pochettino. Rose is
– There's a chance he still goes out.
Yeah, it looks like – it seems like Alderweireld's probably going to stay. Is that a player that he needs to get back on the side?
I think so. Listen, Davinson Sanchez, I like him a lot. And I think the partnership with he and Vertonghen is just as good as the partnership with he and Alderweireld. But if he wants to play Alderweireld, it's sometimes a back three. Yeah. And that's, I mean, to have the three of those guys out there, it's just he needs to get them back on board. And even for him, it's been a long time since he's been a regular at the club level. So, you know, I think his stock is still pretty high, but he needs a good season. I mean, if he wants to leave, just one more good season, and he can angle for a leave for a transfer next summer. Yeah. I mean, Manchester United didn't go in big for him. And you know, I think it's good for him to say, don't get on Pochettino's bad side. We've seen players that have done that, and it's a quick ticket to the under 19 team or just, you know, where are they now?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right, so my last pick in the top four, which again is controversial. I was the only one that had,
which
Arsenal.
I'm also a little surprised by, but
only one that had Arsenal in the top four. I guess you wouldn't be surprised in that they're coming off of their worst season ever under Arsene Wenger and didn't strengthen big time. I mean, have been strengthening lately, but didn't really strengthen big time in the summer. I mean, listen, every club around them has a serious argument for finishing higher than Arsenal. I just think the one area that everyone has been talking about, everyone has been moaning about, is just that tactical obdurance of Arsene Wenger to not set the team up to be good without the ball, right? And you can look at clubs that have immediately won titles just by focusing on that. I think Chelsea is a perfect example of a club that had the right parts, but just a bit of inconsistency and a bit of naivete and stars that were bailing them out from time to time. And all of a sudden, two managers come in, Jose Mourinho and Antonio Conte, and they turn them into a defense-first group that sits compact, organized, and springs on the counterattack, and they go and win titles in their first seasons. Now, that doesn't mean that always works, but I just think in the Premier League, it's rare for someone, this is why no one thought Pep Guardiola could do it, for someone to focus on attack first, right? Yeah. Now, I think that there's a bit of a misconception with Pep that he doesn't set up to defend and doesn't set up for life without the ball. Mm-hmm. He actually sets up for life without the ball by possessing it. So mm-hmm. one of the things that's a staple and a pillar of his philosophy is create the spatial awareness and the angles to win the ball back by being set up, keeping the ball. So keep the ball until we're in a great structure and a great formation to play triangles, to play passing lanes, to isolate creative players facing forward. But it doubles as a pressing technique, which isn't an all-out press, you know, sort of chaotic, you know, Pochettino, Liverpool, you know, gegenpressing thing. It's a, we're set up, when we lose the ball, we're in a perfect position to win it back. Mm-hmm. So even he has a focus on that. I mean, Arsene Wenger just, I mean, he had either a mental block or just didn't know how to do it, but they never worked on that. So
or just
right,
stubborn.
Yeah, I think it worked when he got there, mm-hmm. right? This kind of, this poetic, give the players freedom, let them express themselves, along with great value buys and sports science. He was a vanguard, right? He was ahead of his time and just mm-hmm. didn't evolve. Now you have to set your team up to be strong and tough to break down without the ball, and also set it up as an attacking weapon, how you win it back. And so Unai Emery, not as much at PSG because they were so dominant, but at Valencia, at Sevilla, he definitely worked on this and had a talented group that could possess the ball. And if you go across some of his teams, had similar players to the ones he has now in the Premier League. This is still a very, very talented squad. He's just going to work a lot with them on who they're going to be without the ball. And against Manchester City, in their opening game of the season at the Emirates, we saw it. Like, we saw what he was trying to do. It's just the execution's not there yet. So they tried to sit in kind of a medium block, close down passing lanes, shift as a unit left and right, and then press from time to time centrally through Ramsey, who tried to disrupt Fernandinho and tried to hurry Manchester City in their build-up and force them to make mistakes there. Now, Manchester City's so good that they just played around it a lot of times. But in transition, Arsenal looked dangerous. They won the ball back. They were just really uncharacteristically sloppy. And I had said that on the broadcast, and of course, you know, someone on Twitter who's just a genius said, you know, that's, I said something like, even when Arsenal are bad, you know, in seasons when they're bad, they're known for still being a great attacking side. You know, they can frustrate and be languid in the final third, mm-hmm. but even at a default, they're clean and crisp with the ball. I mean, that's who Arsenal
is. They're still attractive to watch.
And, you know, and this guy said, you know, no, Arsenal's, you know, I guess his point was that they're bad in the attacking third. I don't know what his point was. Anyway, I digress. You know, that was a bit worrying in their opening game, that they were so focused on who they needed to be without the ball and obviously all the work they've done there, that they struggled a lot of times when they won it.
Yeah.
But I didn't look at that opening game as a negative. You know, Guendouzi, this young French player who it was big and bold to start a 19-year-old in the deep-lying position against Manchester City. And hindsight, maybe a mistake, but I love that he did it. Mm-hmm. You know, Arsene Wenger trusted Cesc Fabregas when he was a 16-year-old. So this kid created and developed out of the PSG Academy is fluid, is beautiful on the ball. He has the composure of a Santi Cazorla. He's got the passing range of kind of a young Cesc Fabregas when he was there. He loves to play positive, loves to turn on the ball. He had a bad game, and he kept him in there, which is the other thing I loved, is he let this young kid try to play through a bad performance.
Well, I was going to say, because he actually took out Ramsey and Granit Xhaka, the other two midfielders. So he definitely wanted to make a change in midfield, and he took those two out instead of Guendouzi, and he brought in Torreira, and then he actually brought in Lacazette for more attack.
Yeah, and Lacazette helped out a lot when he came on.
Which Aubameyang actually brought up, that he really likes playing with Lacazette. So I don't know if he's trying to push for that to be the case. But I'm curious, you think that midfield, those midfield decisions, you think that was more for Guendouzi to get the experience, or could there be something there where Ramsey, Xhaka, your place isn't, just because you were playing a lot last season, your place isn't secure now You know, I have Lucas Torreira now that can come in.
Totally.
I've started Guendouzi. There's other guys you can bring in, Lacazette, and play more attacking minded. So
totally.
Could that be a more a power move too from Emery to say, you guys, you're not as safe as you think you might be?
Yeah, I mean, if you were gonna guess his lineup before the game, you would have said Torreira before Guendouzi. Yeah. You needed a bit more steel, you needed mobility, you needed someone that could disrupt a buildup and even if he couldn't win the ball, just get around players. Yeah. So I was surprised with that. But I think Ramsey, the statement was actually a more positive one with Ramsey. He played Ramsey in, I guess you could say, the number 10 playmaking role a little bit. You know, at times it was more of a sort of inverted triangle rather than two holders. But Ramsey enjoyed a lot of freedom centrally, and that's what Ramsey's always wanted. I mean, you know, when he plays in a deep role and bombs forward, that's always hurt Arsenal because it leaves a defensive midfielder without the mobility to cover that space exposed. So Ramsey's been talking about a new contract and all this sort of stuff. So I think it was kind of a Ramsey, you're going to be important, because he essentially gave Ramsey the role that Ozil wants. And in the second half, Mesut Ozil moved into an attacking midfield role. Out of all the midfield issues, I don't think Granit Xhaka is the answer. I think Torreira's going to start here eventually. I think Guendouzi's the long-term project he wants. And then it's just about, you know, I think Ramsey's a great third option. Who ends up being the option centrally? And I think if you look at some of his previous teams, I think he's going to move towards Aubameyang playing off the left, Lacazette through the middle, and give the right side to Mesut Ozil if he can come alive. I mean, yeah.
What about Mkhitaryan then?
Yeah, Mkhitaryan just so Mkhitaryan and Mesut Ozil, like. I think more troubling was Ozil, who you hear me every weekend. I'm like trying so hard in the studio to defend him. He's world class. I love watching him play. I know he frustrates everyone. I think sometimes he looks lazier and looks more disinterested than the numbers will show or that the reality of the impact he has on a game. But it was kind of. It was hard to defend his performance on Sunday because, again, like I said about Arsenal when they get on the ball, I couldn't believe some of his lack of vision, poor touches, you know, just missing sequences, trying difficult passes that weren't even close to coming off. He just really struggled to get in the game. And then Mkhitaryan was just anonymous. It wasn't that he tried things that didn't come off. Mm-hmm. He literally just didn't try anything. Yeah. So that was troubling that those two players who have to have big seasons if they want to finish top four struggle.
This might be a little harsh on Mesut Ozil, but he just kind of reminded me of Jay Cutler a little bit, where you watch you just kind of look at him sometimes and you just think, is this guy really, does he really care all the time? Is he really, and it's hard to say with Ozil because he's won a World Cup. And
yeah.
He's won.
I get that. I mean, I get
but
that.
But I think
criticism.
I think that's what people think sometimes when they see him. They look at his body language and they think he seems disinterested or he's not working hard sometimes. And I just don't know if that's always the case. But yeah, the game on Sunday was pretty poor. And you called that one, so you were
it was bad.
You were watching it.
It was bad. Here's the thing with Ozil is that's all he has is club football. So he's not retired from international.
Yeah, I have a feeling he's going to come back.
Really?
I think he's going to wait.
How old is he?
He's 28? I'll double check. 29? He's 28 or 29.
So I mean, he has maybe one more World Cup, at least a Euros.
He's
going
to do a Euros if he wants. He's 29. He's going to turn 30.
A Euros for
30 in a couple months.
So I mean, yeah. Who knows if that situation? We can't begin to understand the impact of a dual national with his heritage and the issues he's had to deal with and the criticism he's faced. It's hard enough in the game to face, you know, criticism, especially with social media and all that. And there's nowhere to escape from people just being vitriolic and awful to you. And it's obviously had an impact on him and his quality of life. And to walk away from a national team is a big, big decision. Mm-hmm. But with that said, it puts a lot of pressure on you enjoying life with your club team, right? And he's just first game out of the season, you'd say that's not happening. Yeah. So it's early days, early doors. I just think there's enough quality in this Arsenal side. I think Unai Emery was not the perfect manager to get. I think there are better options, but is the perfect manager in that he will make them strong where they were weak. And then, you know, the muscle memory and the freedom and the attacking flair and confidence will come back. I just think it's going to take some time, right? I mean, look at replacing Arsene Wenger. I mean, the guy's two decades of of trophies and of success and then frustration. I mean, the guy even picked out the cushions on the seats in the stadium. I mean, he's been a part of everything.
Yeah.
To think overnight you're going to go from the worst season ever under Arsene Wenger to beating Manchester City at home, mm-hmm. even though they thrashed you last time they were there, is just unrealistic, especially when you compare it to Sir Alex Ferguson left a title-winning side. And it's been several years and a few managers, and they still haven't come anywhere close mm-hmm. to getting up to that height again. Yeah. So it's just, there's no time in modern football, but it's going to take a bit of time with Arsenal. All right. So that brings us outside of the top four. We're into Europa League places. And I've got Manchester United at fifth. So I think I was the only one to have Manchester United outside of the top mm-hmm. four. Now, that's going to surprise no one on this podcast, especially the Manchester United fans that are sitting there in their car or on their walk right now or in their house saying, here we go, Martino. What is it with you and Mourinho? This is not going to surprise anyone. I've said it from the moment he was linked with the Manchester United job. This is going to end poorly. Mm-hmm. This is going to end without a title, and it's going to end poorly. And everything about this summer, I think, strengthens that position. So they didn't spend a lot. They spent a lot more than others, but didn't spend a lot in terms of what Jose Mourinho wanted. Jose Mourinho wanted center backs. He wanted Maguire. He wanted Boateng. He wanted, Alderweireld. He wanted to strengthen a part of the field that Ed Woodward said, no. You want to know why? Because we've given you $500 million since you've been here, and a lot of that was on what position? Mm-hmm. Center back. Lindelof. Baye. I mean, Baye was your first buy, your first purchase. Yep. And you sat him last year because you wanted Chris Smalling, another center back you don't seem to love all that much, to go to the World Cup. I'm sorry. No. We backed you there, and you haven't gotten it done, which has led to an even bigger discussion with Manchester United about, is it time for a director of football? So they seem to be, if you believe the reports, in the process of finally hiring one of several hats that Sir Alex Ferguson wore. So they're one of the last sort of the bastion of the old way. The manager is a manager. He's responsible for more than just, the training and the team on the weekend. You know, he gets to pick his players he wants to buy. He gets to run. Those days are over. Mm-hmm. And for clubs that are still living in that time, they're going to find out pretty quickly those days are over with how transient the game is, how quick players move, how quick managers move. It's very short term. And in order to have any stability and maintain any identity as a football club, you need someone that stays, that understands the technical nous of a game and can identify talent and playing style and construct a system that supports that. You need someone to stay after all of this stuff goes up in flames, right?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because Mourinho in his post-match interview brought that up himself. He said that us managers, we should no longer have the title manager. We should just be called head coach because we don't have those.
But he said that in a sarcastic way. So I read the article and I thought the same thing as you. It's like, all right, finally, how he said it was, well, I guess we're not managers anymore. I guess he just, I guess we're not important.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, everything about his preseason was miserable. Mm-hmm. I mean, when his criticism of when they were playing in the ICC, and why would anyone come pay to watch us play? This isn't our team. Just everything about the offseason was miserable Mourinho.
Yeah.
And then he gets into the preseason, and they're moments away from starting their campaign, and he starts a fight with Ed Woodward. I mean, it's this me against them thing of, I asked for these players, he didn't give them to me. And I'm just thinking to myself, Ed Woodward is a commercial guru. I mean, really, David Gill, no one's replaced what he was able to do. Sir Alex Ferguson and Gill had this incredible relationship where they ran the club, and it worked for so long, incredible success. And Ed Woodward isn't that's why another reason why they need a director of football. He's not the one who's going to help. He's not like a Cheeky Begiristain who can help construct and build that and has a track record of success in that way. He's a commercial guru. He gets sponsorship deals. He leverages the value of a club, and he gets big dollars to come in. What is he looking at? He's looking at what sells jerseys, what sells this brand. You know what does it? Paul Pogba. So if Jose Mourinho is going to pick a fight with Ed Woodward, and Paul Pogba and Jose Mourinho are not seeing eye to eye, which they're not. Don't buy anything about these guys getting along. Where do you think Ed Woodward is going to where is his allegiance? Where is he going to put his focus to making Paul Pogba happy and getting a manager that will make Paul Pogba happy? You know what manager that might make Paul Pogba happy? One that speaks his language.
that's been the latest rumor. Yeah. I think I know where you're going.
maybe a legend that
who's on the market?
Who's on the market and has had success at a club you'd have to say is bigger than Manchester United. So Zinedine Zidane, whether you believe it or not, and I do, because this rumor was circulating before reports started.
Yeah.
He's interested in the Manchester United job. You go for Zinedine Zidane all day long, not only because of his success at Real Madrid, his ability to manage a huge club, his iconic status, that incredible formula which Pep has of success on the field and success off of it, which is kind of rare because being good on the field doesn't necessarily mean you'll be a great coach. More often than not, it means you'll struggle as a coach, especially if you were a legend. And you definitely get Paul Pogba on board right away. So Jose Mourinho is slowly isolating himself, and all of the fights that he picks, right, with Ed Woodward, with Luke Shaw, with Paul Pogba, with anyone who gets in his way, right, with Martial, who, by the way, he said Martial came back too late to start and feature in their first game. Paul Pogba came back 4 days after Martial. So this whole gaslighting Mourinho divide people, it's you're either with me or with them. Everyone's going with them because a lot of the transfers that they missed were people not saying no to Manchester United. They're people saying no to Jose Mourinho. It's people saying, listen, I don't want to play for that guy. And, you know, Mkhitaryan, when he moved to Arsenal, and listen, say he was a failure, say whatever. He said, I want to play attacking football. I wasn't happy there. Didier Deschamps says Paul Pogba is not happy there. Mm-hmm. So at some point, one of two things need to happen. Jose Mourinho needs to start winning and make everyone believe there's a title at the end of this, or he needs to acquiesce and start being a little friendlier, a little
welcoming.
Less antagonistic. Yeah, but that's not going to happen, right? I mean, this is the first time ever he's going into a third season without a title. A third season, if you go back in history, tends to absolutely blow up in spectacular fashion. He doesn't have his number two, Rui Faria. So everything about this, I think Jose Mourinho is on unsteady ground. And for the first time, no one believes his bark. I just think it's going to become quite comical this season when he tries to do the everyone's against me, you know, thing. You know, this Barcelona for Paul Pogba thing is not going away. Mm-hmm. Paul Pogba's not leaving this transfer window, but it's not going away. And Mino Raiola, Pep Guardiola told us, shopped Paul Pogba in the winter transfer window to Pep Guardiola.
Yeah, well,
he said, he came to me and said, do you want Paul Pogba? So you have Paul Pogba's agent trying to get him out of Manchester United. You have Ed Woodward probably doing everything he can to keep him at Manchester United. And I think the way you keep Paul Pogba at Manchester United and the way you win a title with Manchester United, not this season, but soon, is to get rid of Jose Mourinho.
Well, so I was going to, you know, we just talked about they didn't bring anybody in the transfer market, but the squad overall is still pretty good. They definitely could have used some improvements, but, you know, you talked about Bailly. And also Lindelof played. He started the game. Who also played, if I'm not mistaken, every single game for Sweden, who made it to the quarterfinals of the World Cup at center back. So it's not like he can't play at a top level.
By the way, that back four of Shaw, Lindelof, Bailly,
and
Darmian is that's basically
all his rejects.
The misfit toys. So exactly. The ones that are like, get me out of here.
And they came through. I was just saying, Luke Shaw got his first scored
and
his first
good.
Career goal. I mean, they've got obviously they have Pogba, Lukaku. So you talk about getting rid of Mourinho. Do you think it's a case the sooner the better? And maybe they can actually, I don't know if the title might be a little bit asking for a lot, but they can make a run here and not be in danger of, like you're thinking that they might be out of the top four. If they bring in someone like Zidane in a couple weeks or something like that.
If Zidane said, I'll come now, I fire Jose Mourinho and get Zinedine Zidane. Mm-hmm. Because they're not winning the title this year. Even if they have a great season. Listen, even if they have a great season, and they could. I could eat a lot of crow here. They could finish second. But for Jose Mourinho to say his best accomplishment as a manager and one of his greatest accomplishments is to finish trophyless in second place a mile behind their city rivals. To say that is so offensive, yeah. and it's essentially saying, I had a great season, this club's just not very good, and these players just aren't very good. I mean, that is so offensive to say, by the way, out of one side of his mouth, list all the trophies you've won. Every time anyone criticizes your style and what it looks like and how hard it is to watch your team, to go down the list of all the things you've won and then say one of the greatest accomplishments of your managerial career is to win nothing, it is so offensive. Yeah. If I could get Zinedine Zidane right now, and I'm Ed Woodward, I say, Jose, it's been great. No need to come to the stadium. We'll send your stuff. You know, it's been a joy. Because it's kind of like when you fire like a traitor and you don't let them go back to their desk and put on like crazy, you know, trades and stuff. Like, I'd just be so worried because he blows everything up on his way out that if I fire him, he's going to come back in and, you know, get in the ear of people. And the guy leaves a crisis in his wake. And I understood why Manchester United took that risk against the recommendation of so many, against the recommendation of the legend Sir Bobby Charlton. I understand why they took that risk because they really were spinning. They were struggling to become stable after Sir Alex Ferguson. But without trophies, Jose Mourinho's not worth it. And there are no trophies coming in the near future that are going to make the destruction he's going to leave behind him worth it. So the opportunity cost of missing out on Zinedine Zidane right now is so great that I think I'm willing to embarrass us by firing Jose Mourinho early. I'm willing to say this is so uncharacteristic of Manchester United, but when you have a Zinedine Zidane manager, they could have gotten Klopp, they could have gotten Pochettino, they could have gotten Antonio Conte, they could have gotten, probably not Pep Guardiola, but managers who have been incredibly successful in the Premier League recently, Manchester United could have hired all of those guys.
Yeah.
They need to go get Zinedine Zidane right now and cut their losses with Jose Mourinho.
And all they have to do is look at when Zidane came into Real Madrid. They were a mess with Rafa Benitez. And he came in right away and led them to the Champions League final that they won, and they won two more after that. So he's got a track where he's only managed one team, but he has a track record of coming in, and he can turn around a team that's in complete disarray and lead them to trophies.
And Paul Pogba, by the way, he gave a very rare interview through the mix zone, and he almost never goes through the mix zone after a game. And for those that don't know, after a game, when you see interviews where players are standing in front of, you know, either the club sponsors and all that stuff, or they're walking through and a lot of microphones in their face, that's the mix zone. It's where a lot of the reporters and journalists internationally are standing to get good sound bites interviews after game. Paul Pogba normally dips those, which, listen, he's not required to stop there. He does his required interviews and stops and does autographs. So I'm not saying he's a bad guy at all, but he stopped this time, which is really interesting. Yeah. He stopped to make a point, and he stopped to get on the record. Mm-hmm. He's got social media. Yeah. He can send a tweet out. He can do whatever. And correct me if I'm wrong with the quote, but the quote was something like,
I've got it right here.
You read it.
It says, if you're not happy, you cannot give your best. There are things I cannot say, otherwise I will get fined. That was the key bite.
I mean, wow.
Yeah.
And the question was something along the lines of, it was kind of trying to get him to talk about transfer, you know, the moves and are you happy here at Manchester United?
Yeah, I think it was basically, are you happy?
Yeah. And I mean, wow.
And he said, if you're not happy, you cannot give your best.
And here's another thing he said. He said this word 3 or 4 times, trust. He said, you know, I play my best when someone trusts me. He didn't mean Jose Mourinho. We made a big thing about it, and we should have, about him having the armband for the game. Mm-hmm. Now, there was no real captain on the field. You'd say maybe David De Gea. But that was a good move from Jose Mourinho. You know, an olive branch, say, here's the armband. You know, I'm going to trust you. But Paul Pogba essentially is saying, Jose needs to get on board. I read his quotes as saying, listen, you want the best. You want what you saw with France. You want what you saw with Juventus. Mm-hmm. You want what I can do. I need a manager that trusts me. And so I think he's saying, Jose, are you going to come along and trust me?
Yeah.
Otherwise, like, why? And that's how everyone read it. Yeah. And listen, he could have gone afterwards on Twitter or whatever and cleared that up. Mm-hmm. He basically was saying, things are not good between me and this guy.
Yeah. Well, you bring up the captaincy. Mourinho was asked about that too. And he said, well, you know, normally Valencia would be the captain, but he couldn't play today, so that's why. I had to give it to somebody. So why can't he just say, it was a good opportunity for Paul, so I decided to let him. You know, he just can't say, even if it's just lip service, he just can't do it.
But by the way, crushed Valencia, too. Yeah. I mean, he was super critical of Valencia for his preseason performance.
Yeah.
It's just, I just think what made – and listen, I know I do it. And Manchester United fans, I'm sorry. I don't like Jose Mourinho. And I don't have to like him to respect him. I 100% respect him. I mean, this guy will go down as one of the best managers of all time, for sure. Now, I mean, none of this taints or ruins the legacy. I mean, he will be remembered as an incredible – that knee slide with Porto at Old Trafford, I mean, in the suit. I mean, the treble with Inter. I mean, some incredible things that other managers couldn't have done. It's just the way he has to be successful, I don't really appreciate it. I don't like it. I don't like to watch it. I don't like to deal with how he treats people. And when it doesn't succeed, it looks awful.
Yep.
And that's where I'm at with that. So at me. So at me, because I still love you guys. I still love you guys. Even though I just annoy you season after season. Season 3's here, and the last team we have for the top six. This one might be, I think they're all kind of slightly controversial. Well, but I mean, Chelsea.
If you're a
fan
of any of the big six, you think you're going to be in the top four no matter what. So somebody's always
pissed at me. Chelsea at six. Here's my Chelsea thing. Courtois is gone. That's at least 8 points.
You think 8 points?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, David De Gea is 18 points. That's at least 8 points right there. I mean, the guy's top. And the reason I say 8 points is because moving to a back four is going to take a bit of time. It's a bit of a shift. So they were going to need him more this year than last. Kepa, very talented, young player, athletic, good off his line, great with his feet. Just kind of this new, you know, he kind of fits into this new category of, you know, if you took a really talented field player who was great with his hands and put gloves on him. Yeah. But still, I mean, the price tag, the most expensive goalkeeper ever, the inexperience. I mean, hasn't really played a ton. I mean, you'd say, like, club level, I mean, he's now experienced enough where you don't think that this is a big risk, but, like, not an international, right? So, like, this is a big, big move. And then you have David Luiz sitting in front of him. Right. So, like, I love David Luiz for the reasons that Sarri does, but the reasons that Conte hated him. He's going to be a liability. He was really good in a back three because he essentially got to play free.
He's like a free safety.
Yeah. And he's smart, so he can read the game well. Essentially, he was cutting off angles, but not dealing with runners into central locations, not really playing 1v1 all that often, and was excellent. Also really, really good with the ball out of the back. He's going to be exposed this season because I think from time to time, especially off of the left, you're going to have Alonso forgetting that he's not a wingback anymore.
Yeah.
And I think Azpilicueta will be the strength of the back line because that is his position. He's a fullback. As good as he's been in wingbacks. I mean, this is where I think he's going to be the strongest because he's the best one-on-one defender in the entire Premier League. Mm-hmm. So they're weak towards the left side of their back line, and just go through teams. Salah off of the right side, right? You know now you have Riyad Mahrez off of that side. You know, more than likely Mesut Ozil off of that side. I mean, any great team they're going to play has a really talented right-sided player that loves to either get onto their left foot or is going to burn them around the side. It started to happen. I mean, look at Arsenal. Right. I mean, they don't have a left back right now. I mean, Lichtsteiner ended up going over there. They've been training with Danny Welbeck over there.
Yeah.
I mean, I have a feeling it's going to be the season of if you're weak on the left side of your back line, you're going to get exposed nonstop. I just think it's hard to go from defensive stability after two managers, Mourinho, Antonio Conte, and Sarri. You know, he wants to play 4-3-3 mostly, wants to play vertical, fast, up the field, press from time to time, but not all the time. They will sit back and they will be compact. But typically he's thinking about quickness in transition, get the ball forward, play to our strikers, play to the top three quickly. Not only do I think it's going to take them time to get out of this defensive mode, but I'm not really sure they have the perfect personnel for it.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, Jorginho, I think, is going to get exposed. We saw it in the Community Shield. It's going to get exposed as the lone holder. And Pep Guardiola told us, by the way, in that talk, that that's one thing they tried to do was exploit him and get behind him. Yeah. Antonio Conte, or not Antonio Conte, N'Golo Conte, excellent, as good as it gets, amazing midfielder, but don't play him in a three. And I know France does that from time to time, but don't play him a three because he counts as two people. Mm-hmm. So benefit from the fact that play him deeper, and he will cover ground ahead of him. But if you play him advanced in a three and allow him the freedom to get forward, you're essentially giving the opposition exactly what they want. They're trying to bait N'Golo Kanté out of the middle. They're trying to get him out of those central lanes, and he can cover the ground anyway. So I wonder if at some point they will switch to two holders and one ahead, yeah, which isn't really his system, mm-hmm, or play Kanté deeper and give Jorginho a slightly more advanced role. Now, he probably won't, because at Napoli he loved Jorginho in that role, yeah, and Kanté isn't as... Listen, he doesn't give the ball away a lot, but he just doesn't have as much range and isn't, I think, as intuitive and creative from that deep position as Jorginho is. Yeah. But I worry that to get Eden Hazard on the field, eventually I think what he's going to do is play him through the center, because what works with all his sides is a very mobile center striker. And Morata worries me. Now, he's mobile. He's quick. On a line, he's a lot faster than people think, but he's had a tough preseason. And the fact that he gave up the number 9, I know it's sentimental that it's 29 because he had twins and there's two of them and their birthday is the 29. But come on, man. You don't give up the number 9 at Chelsea. You don't give up the number 9 if you're a goal scorer. You try your whole life to get that jersey.
Especially when there's been a curse associated with Chelsea's number 9, with like Torres had it.
It's psychological. You could tell it was a, man, I'm losing confidence. Mm-hmm. The number 9, like, it's too heavy. It's too big. And like I'd said this on the air, but remember Ivan Zamorano when he was at Inter? And I think it was Ronaldo that came, or no, it was Baggio that came and took 10, and Ronaldo moved from 10 to 9. I think that's what it was, that Ronaldo was like, dude, I want 9. Yeah, and they were like, sorry, I mean, Ronaldo wants 9. And he wore 18 and put a plus in the middle to make it 9 because that's how nutty strikers are. So that was worrying for me. They got rid of Batshuayi. He's off on loan.
Yeah. Do you think they should have done that, though?
No. I mean, because Giroud, I love Giroud, okay? But who's backing up? Who really is backing up? Because Giroud is an even further departure from the way Sarri wants to play than Morata is.
Yeah.
So I don't think, not only do I worry they don't have the pieces, I think the process is going to take a while. I also worry behind the scenes. They still don't have a director of football. I mean, Michael Imanalo left, I think, last winter. Their transfer window wasn't great. The only reason they got Jorginho is because of a relationship with Sarri. So they really didn't do good business. Bakayoko's already left.
Yeah.
I mean,
that was a bust.
Yeah. they spent how much on a kid, Kepa, keeper? Mm-hmm.
71 million, I believe.
I mean,
most expensive goalkeeper of all time now.
It's just, that's not a great window. I worry about them.
So if he elects to go with Hazard through the middle, which means Morata and Giroud go to the bench, do you think they'll be okay with a front three of Willian, Hazard, and Pedro?
Yeah.
If that's what it is?
Yeah, yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
Well, Willian has to be on the field. Mm-hmm. So Willian said recently, and it tells us a lot, because he didn't play a lot last year, and we were all shocked because the season before he was excellent. Mm-hmm. And since he's been there, he's been excellent.
Well, if you look at some of the key matches, like the Barcelona Champions League matches, he was the best player.
Dude, he's brilliant. He's brilliant. I absolutely love him. Mm-hmm. I honestly think if he was treated differently, oh my God, this is the craziest game going on. Sorry, we have the
Super Cup.
We have the Super Cup going on. Oh my God, that made it 3-2 at Atleti.
Which, by the way,
Costa scored at the beginning.
I was going to bring it up real quick.
While we're talking about Chelsea, this is very meta. You know, this is very meta. I mean,
50 seconds in, or less than that, I think.
That, by the way, the Chelsea nightmare starts, and you'll remember it because I remember I taped a little teaser pod when that Costa thing was going on in the offseason from my bedroom, saying, I can't believe they're doing this. Yeah. This is a nightmare. Oh my God, what a goal. What a goal. All right, so at this point in the pod, you're gonna have to watch the third goal for Atletico Madrid. Holy cow, what a finish.
It looks like Saul, I think, yeah.
Oh, that's too good. This is an awkward moment. But that's a beauty. Yeah. What a strike. So
unfortunate for Keylor Navas, his first game after Thibaut Courtois comes in, he gives up 3 goals.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. So for Chelsea, I'm just not optimistic. I think the managerial change in the chaos has worked, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's like 15 years he's been there, 11 managers, and like, or no, what was it? 11 trophies, 15 managers, or something like that. Something crazy since Abramovich has been there. Yeah. And it's worked. I mean, that turnover, that turmoil, it's worked. I just don't see it right now. And listen, as good as Sarri is as a manager, and listen, when Pep Guardiola lauds you and talks about you, you're good. But, I mean, you know, Wanma and other great managers that don't win much, I mean, you love it. It's incredible, yeah. But it's not going to work at Chelsea. Yeah. I mean, you managers that win get fired.
Yeah. No, I know.
I mean, the one that just won an FA Cup got fired.
I remember Fabio Capello won La Liga with Real Madrid, and he was fired that summer.
Yeah.
Because they didn't expect
Di Matteo, so. Champions League. See you later.
He was fired a few months later.
So, Chelsea, I love you guys. But it's gonna be a bit of a struggle this season. It is.
Okay.
And so that's my top six. And it's good to be back, PJ. It's good to see you,
it's
man.
Good to have you back, yeah.
Yeah. Good to be back in the saddle. We've got an exciting weekend coming up. I'm gonna be on the couch watching it. I've got my daughter's birthday party. So I rotated out this weekend so that I could stay married.
Happy birthday, Marlo.
Happy birthday, Marlo. We actually sang as a team. Mm-hmm. It was really, really funny. I'll have to find that video and put it on Twitter. We were at Old Trafford and we sang happy birthday, Marlo, as a group. But Tad Pals, it's so good to be back with you. Well, you know what? Let's do this too. Send me your top six, you know, on Twitter, at Kyle Martino. Send me your top six in order of how they're going to finish. Don't forget the reviews, and don't forget to stay on your feet.